Hello and welcome. I'm Melody Young. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's CMEO briefcase entitled Balancing Act, Navigating Treatments for Psoriasis and Prevention of Psoriatic Arthritis. Today's program is sponsored by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc. I am Melody Young. I am a nurse practitioner in Dallas, Texas. Let's have a look at the learning objectives. It is to incorporate efficacy and safety data for biologics indicated for PSO and PSA in patients as part of treatment decision making. Let's begin with our patient, Amber. Hello, Amber. Thanks for coming in. How are you today?
Hi, Ms. Young. Things are okay. I'm having some issues with my psoriasis, and I'm hoping you can help with that.
I'm sorry to hear that you've been having some symptoms, but we'll see what we can do to help. Could you tell me a little bit more about what's going on?
Well, I have been applying my steroid cream to my knees, elbows, and my hands as directed. It seemed to help somewhat at first, but it doesn't seem to be making much of a difference now. It's also been very itchy, which I'm having trouble sleeping at night because of it.
Okay. I'm sorry that you've been having these issues, Amber, but we will address them. What other symptoms do you think you might be experiencing?
Well, I also noticed that my fingernails are starting to look unusual. My coworkers noticed and said something about it. It was kind of embarrassing. My fingers are starting to swell, as well as my thumbs, which both hurt, but it seems to be worse in the morning whenever I wake up. My right knee is sore and stiff pretty regularly now, which I thought maybe this could be related to my workouts, but it just doesn't seem normal.
Thank you for sharing these issues. Sometimes patients with psoriasis will develop arthritis symptoms, and it's called psoriatic arthritis. This may be what you are experiencing right now. Luckily, we have some great treatments that can help with both symptoms. Can I ask you some more questions so we can figure out the best plan for you?
Of course, Ms. Young, I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Let's review our case. Amber is a 27-year-old female, and she presents to discuss some other options for her skin symptoms. She was diagnosed with mild to moderate PSO about a year ago and had been applying steroid creams and had also used UVB treatments to her affected areas. Her body surface area was at 8%, and she had the typical presentation, the itchy, flaky patches, elbows, knees, hands, and was having some nail changes with little pits that could be seen clinically. She also began to state that she was having some unilateral pain and stiffness in her knees, right knee and both hands, particularly in the morning. And she noticed that three of her fingers and both of her thumbs were tender and a little swollen. So her primary care doctor had done an x-ray. Of course, nothing showed up. And at that time, again, she was using just triamcinolone cream and a phototherapy. She was doing it three times a week. So as we begin to look to kind of see what our options are, looking at biologics and things that could be an option for Amber, this is a great graph that has a wonderful summary of all of the different biologics, their generic name and their trade name, as well as the class of drug, the TNF inhibitors, the one IL-12/23 that we have, IL-23 inhibitors, and then the IL-17 inhibitors, as well as what they're indicated for, because a lot of the biologics will have multiple indications or multiple opportunities for diseases that they can treat, as well as reviewing of the mechanism of action. So TNF inhibitors have many indications for use, including psoriatic arthritis, which Amber presents with today, which is the only TNF-alpha inhibitor available in an IV formulation. I'll let you answer. Infliximab, adalimumab, etanercept, certolizumab, or I don't know. The answer is A, infliximab. It's been available for about 20 years for psoriatic arthritis and is delivered, it's a weight-based drug, and it is delivered by intravenous infusion. So again, looking at the TNF inhibitor options, the first ones to come into the market, first one to be approved for PSO and PSA was etanercept, and it had to be injected twice a week for skin, and then you would go to once a week for psoriatic arthritis or as maintenance, done subcutaneously. And overall, the TNF inhibitors have very similar warnings. That is, you worry about serious infections, tuberculosis, and there are reports of invasive pulmonary fungal infections. There have been reports of demyelinization. The neural pathways, again, lymphomas and other malignancies had been reported with TNF use for in the rheumatologic world, and then, of course, in when it came into dermatology as well. Congestive heart failure was an issue, and there were some other concerns with hepatitis and other changes within the blood counts that had to be monitored. So the warning list, including black box warning, were noted. And the adverse events are listed here. So TNF inhibitors, they've had a great help. They've been a great help to us, but they're what we kind of have been moving away from in the dermatology world and looking for options that would give us similar efficacies, but without all of those warnings that are listed. So efficacy-wise, this is another great slide to look to see exactly what can we expect from this drug and, you know, how clear can they be. And back at the time they came out, we were looking at PASI 75 scores. So when you look at the way that in clinical trials that we score improvements in skin and joints, that we do what's called a PASI score, which really is an overview look of how much body surface area they have and then what the other indicators are, the erythema, the scaliness, the induration. And so those are assessed and then given a numeric value. And that's one way in which you can scientifically have the data you need to show what the efficacy measures are along the process of the weeks to months to years of improvement. And in psoriatic arthritis, it's very similar type of thing, where they're counting the number of tender swollen joints. There are some measures for functionality, but what you're also looking at is for skin, it's PASI 50, PASI 75, and then now we do PASI 75 as a minimum, PASI 90 and a PASI 100. So in the last decade, you really are only looking at drugs that have, we want to see PASI 90s and PASI 100. We want high predictability that these drugs are going to be very, very effective. And for psoriatic arthritis, unfortunately, they don't have, we don't have a drug yet that has 100% of PSA improvement, you know, 100% of the time. Having an ACR score, the American College of Rheumatology score, of 20% improvement is enough that can make a difference in a patient's pain and functionality. When you get an ACR of 50, it's even more impressive. And then an ACR of 70 is significantly impressive with the reduction in the activity of the psoriatic arthritis. So these are not things that you really do in clinical practice. It's just most of the time we say, are you better? You know, or how we look to see how much of their disease is gone and how they're feeling and how their hands are moving. And we ask those questions more. It's what we do in clinical practice and just an overall global assessment of their progress. But it's good to know what those two metrics are so you can do some comparing and contrasting of all these different medications. Now we really want to look at PASI 90, PASI 100, and even the best one that's listed for the data being available at PASI 100, it's 17.1%, which is adalimumab. And then looking at the ACR scores of 20, 50, and 70 in the rheumatology world, you know, most people can get an ACR 20 with these drugs, particularly with infliximab. And then the ACR 50 and 70, again, it kind of diminishes. The infusible drug has the highest rate response. The others, you know, 13 to 25% of people getting the ACR 70. So again, been very effective. There were other things we think about with TNF inhibitors with pregnancy. Certolizumab has some good data in pregnancy, and it's the only one of the TNF inhibitors to present that. There are some that are absolute no-nos, like methotrexate, that don't want to do that. And then the other background information you want to know about, do they have a history of demyelinization worries or a family history? Is there heart failure? Am I going to have an impact on that? Thinking about, you know, malignancy, the questions that people always want to know, self-injections versus going in for infusions, a lot of things to consider within TNFs. Then the next category we move into are the IL-17 inhibitors. They also have indications for both skin and joint disease. So secukinumab is dosed, you dose it 300 milligrams each week for 4 weeks, and then you move into an every 4 week dose thereafter. And it's whether you're treating the skin, the joints you can dose at half that, 150 instead of 300. But of course, in our world, we only use the 300 because we need the skin effect as well. The adverse events on the IL-17s, looking at both of them, are very, very similar. You know, you worry about particularly upper respiratory infections, injection site reactions are a possibility. With secukinumab, there were some reports of eczematous reactions. And then the inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, of an activation or a reactivation that had been reported in some trials. And of course, with this and all the biologics, you want to avoid live vaccines if possible when you're undergoing dosing, because you just don't know if they're going to be effective. So ixekizumab, looking at it below, it has more dosing. So it has an every other week dosing regimen for the first 12 weeks. Then it goes to every four thereafter. And the side effects are also very, very similar. And again, hypersensitivity reactions, you can see that across the board with the orals and the injectable medications. So efficacy rates in skin with these IL-17s, with PASI 100, ixekizumab showing a greater percentage of folks getting that PASI 100. And then as far as the ACR 70 scores, the highest thing that we monitor or tool that we measure for joint. So about a little bit more than half of both of these drugs with ACR 20, and very similar in the ACR 50, but then getting up to the ACR 70, again, these numbers are just very, very similar for joints, but with ixekizumab showing a little bit higher numbers from the skin perspective. So the I mentioned before the inflammatory bowel disease issue that may be unmasked when they're on an IL-17. So patients should be screened for this and try to avoid IL-17s in patients with known Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, and hopefully can use a drug that will work in both, or at least one that won't exacerbate it. There were some new cases in both of these clinical trials, and they were large numbers of patients, so the percentages were actually a little bit lower than what we expected to see, because with patients with psoriatic arthritis, it can be as much as 3% of those folks can have ulcerative colitis or inflammatory bowel disease. So the next class of drug that we talked about, or we're going to clump the IL-12/23s, which is ustekinumab, and the IL-23s together. And so all three of these have been approved for skin and joints. And the ustekinumab and risankizumab are both dosed. You get a dose a month later, and then after that, it's every 12 weeks. Guselkumab, you actually dose at 0, week 4, and then you do it every 8 weeks thereafter. So the dosing is just a little bit different. They're all delivered subcutaneous. They all have, it's the same dose regardless of weight, except for ustekinumab. It is dosed up to 100 kilos is the difference. But for the other two, no. Adverse events, again, looking across the board, very, very similar. There are more warnings listed on the ustekinumab, but that was because a lot of those were added as a class effect, meaning biologics overall, and turned out to be something that was not carried on with additional medicines that were approved. But we really, you know, consider the IL-23 safety profile to be pretty impressive. So across the board, you're going to test them for TB before they start. You don't have to do any other labs unless you choose to do that. The same with IL-17s. None of those are required. But you're going to see some upper respiratory infection type of issues. There are a few reports of tinea infections with the IL-23s, guselkumab, and risankizumab. Very low risk and very, as far as adverse events or serious infections, again, extremely low percentages in both of those IL-23s. So when you look at efficacy, you can see why people has moved away from the ustekinumab with the amount of people getting the PASI 90 or PASI 100 compared to the IL-23 inhibitors themselves. Looking at, you know, numbers in the high 30s to low 40s, the amount of patients that are getting a PASI 100. And then when you look at the ACR scores, again, about half of patients will get an ACR 20 improvement. And then when you start looking at the 50 to the ACR 70, you're talking about, you know, 1 out of 4 to 1 out of 5 patients having those results. So very good evidence that these drugs will be effective and effective in a relatively speedy fashion within months of initiation. So now that you're trying to decide which one you're going to pick, let me ask you this question. Which is true regarding the prevention of PSA in patients with PSO receiving biologics? That there is no evidence that PSA can be prevented with biologics, or only oral therapies have evidence for PSA prevention? Or C, ustekinumab is the only therapy to have evidence that suggests PSA may be prevented with its use? Or D, that IL-12/23s and IL-23 inhibitors have evidence that suggest PSA may be prevented with their use, or E, I don't know. You may not have known this, but it's D, IL-12/23 and IL-23 inhibitors now have evidence that suggests that PSA may be prevented with their use. So that's, I actually asked to have this full article because this is new information. It's very important. It's something we've always hoped for, but now we have evidence of it. So when you use IL-12/23 for psoriasis, it seemed to suppress subclinical enthesitis through week 52, and the risk of PSA became significantly reduced. The mean inflammatory scores for psoriasis in patients decreased by over 40% within the first 24 weeks. And in a study of ustekinumab patients versus healthy volunteers, that this was how the data was obtained to show that there was a reduction in the amount of psoriatic arthritis that developed. And this was also looking at the 1 IL-12/23 and the 2 IL-23s, also compared to the TNF inhibitors. So what is this going to mean for practitioners? Well, I think we're going to take that into account a lot when we start trying to make a decision for patients when they have known evidence of psoriatic arthritis, signs and symptoms, as well as concerns that could be something, because patients with moderate to severe skin disease are more likely to develop psoriatic arthritis within years, within a decade of their original skin disease manifesting. And now we might have an opportunity to impact that. So another thing that's interesting is biosimilars. So biosimilars have come into the market for the TNFs that we use, as well as ustekinumab. but they are not identical to original biologic. They are considered biosimilars, not identicals, and they still have the same treatment risk and benefits. The studies, fortunately, are showing that there's very similar efficacy and no significant difference in the discontinuation rate. So a lot of similarities. So going back to our patient, Amber, this young lady that has had skin disease for quite some time, up to 8% body surface area, was beginning to having signs and symptoms of arthritis or arthropathies and needing to look for other options. So factors that you begin to look at, what other kind of health problems does she have? If I start to think, well, I'm going to use either a TNF inhibitor, an IL-17 inhibitor, or an IL-23 inhibitor as my preferred action, I want to think about all the things we just talked about. Does she have any other comorbidities, concerns? Is there a history of Crohn's or ulcerative colitis within her family? Are we concerned about pregnancy? Is she planning for pregnancy in the near future? How much this disease is impacting her, whether or not she's adverse to giving herself injections. There are a multitude of things that I want to think about, and I'm going to do basic things like check her for tuberculosis status and then help her make decisions about which therapy we're going to go with. And then we also think about the mechanism of action because she has high likelihood of having psoriatic arthritis, and there's not a test for that. X-ray findings are not going to show up until years of damage have occurred, and there's not a blood test for it. So it's got to be a clinical diagnosis. And she has failed creams and phototherapy, and it's time to move on. So again, I'm not which one of these classes of drugs that I'm going to think about. And then sometimes you think about simple things like, is she okay with, you know, does she want something that she's going to dose weekly or every other week or monthly versus something she could look at, you know, 6 times a year or 5 times a year. And then I also go through the process of elimination. I know methotrexate isn't an option for her at her age, and it's just the data is just not there. So for me, I'm looking at safety, I'm looking at efficacy, and I'm looking for simplicity in the administration of the drug, the access and administration for a young lady that's going to likely be facing this disease, you know, for the rest of her life. And I want to intervene and use something that's going to minimize the destruction to her skin and to her joints over the next many decades. So I do want to have a customized treatment for her and for all of my patients. I want to think about specifics about the mechanism of action, the method of delivery of the medication, and also the things that are going to be most effective for skin and joints clinically. And then I, of course, think about that the efficacy and then the safety data. A lot of patients who heard about biologics think about the first ones that we got 20 years ago and some of the, you know, black box warnings that we saw with the TNF inhibitors that we don't have now on the IL-17 inhibitors or the IL-23 inhibitors, so that her decisions are made on good, sound evidence and not just rumors or things of concern maybe they saw in ads on TV. And again, as I mentioned, you know, what are her risks for these other immune type diseases, including inflammatory bowel disease? And now the other major consideration is for protection against PSA, so that by intervening with a medicine that is likely to give her current improvement, in fact, even clearance of her skin as a high likelihood, and improvement in her signs and symptoms of psoriatic arthritis, that also can protect her from developing that disease in a full-blown way. That's very, very important. So some of the considerations that you may have a concern about, and I've heard a lot of discussion among clinics around the country, is what to do with vaccinations. And the main thing is live vaccines are not known whether or not they're effective when a person is on a biologic, and that's a biologic overall. So there are guidelines that can help you know what to do if you have a patient that needs a live vaccine. They're going to travel internationally, for example, that can give you guidance on what to do with your biologics. But in my clinical practice, I do not withhold any of the biologics based on a person's immunization status. There's some thought that maybe starting something like the zoster vaccines for people that are going to be on JAK inhibitors is recommended. But you should not, there's nothing that says that you should withhold biologics based on that's their vaccine status. Just know if they're going to need a live vaccine at some point, you may need to get some information about how do you fit that in to their biologic routine. As far as infections go, most of the IL-1223s and the IL-17s have infection rates that are very similar to placebo, maybe 1 to 2% difference compared to placebo, particularly related to serious infections. So in my clinic, one of the things that I do is if you have fever, if you're throwing up, if you're sick enough to not go to work or go to school that day, and it's your injection day, when you have these drugs that are only dosed either every 4, 8, or 12 weeks, you have a little bit of leeway. In the clinical trials, those patients were allowed some flexibility where you could inject them some days early if they were going to travel, or if they were sick or going to be gone or something, you could inject those medications some days later and still be considered within the scope of what was required for the trial. So in my clinic, if you have an infection and you feel bad and you're having fever or just don't feel good, just put your injection off by a few days. Wait till it clears. That was allowed in trials and it just makes sense. And fortunately, it's not something we see that often, but with all the, you know, this time of year, in the wintertime, there's a lot going around. It's nice to know that you can do that and not alter the person's course of their treatment or therapy, and helps them know that you may get infections. Yes, you're going to be on these drugs over the long haul, over years, and we're going to need to be able to have some flexibility if you have other things going on. Okay, so we talked about what therapy we want to put Amber on to start with. So the other things that I think about are the long-term monitoring. So I've said you want to do TB testing before you start on any of these biologics, but whether or not you need to do it from then on, that's going to be up to you. It's sometimes you do it based on their occupation or their risk, or if they had signs or symptoms of a respiratory infection, of course. But as far as following up in my clinic, once I know what their expected clearance rate should be, 1 month into it, 2 months, 3 months, if at 3 months they're not significantly better in skin and joints, I want to see them. I want to evaluate, talk about it, make sure they're doing everything right, and make sure that, you know, my diagnosis is correct. But then thereafter, once they're up and running and they're doing well, a lot of these patients we see twice a year. Sometimes we do some telemed visits just to check in and see how they're doing to continue it, to keep them going. And, you know, psoriasis can flare at different times. Psoriatic arthritis can flare at different times. So it's good just to maintain that relationship with her and keep her encouraged to stay on her therapy over the long haul. So our goals in treating patients, we're going to call them the SMART goals. They're specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. What that means is we want to be able to deliver customized care to our patients with psoriatic disease. That's based on our clinical considerations and how they're going to fit within what that patient needs clinically as well within their lifestyle. We want to utilize the efficacy and safety data that we have in a shared decision-making process with those patients who are suffering with psoriatic disease. We also have to consider other issues, pregnancy, inflammatory bowel disease, and that new thing that we have, which is the potential for PSA protection as we develop treatment plans for patients with psoriatic disease. I hope today's CMEO briefcase has been helpful for you. It is part of a three-part series, and the impact of psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis and what matters when engaging with patients. The second one will be decoding psoriatic arthritis and applying evidence-based guidelines for individualized and effective treatment. There are free resources available to you through the Dermatology Hub to help educate healthcare professionals and their patients on dermatology. And here's the website available. To receive credit for today's participation for this activity, you need to complete the post-test and do the evaluation online, and then you'll be able to download and print your certificate immediately upon completion. Thank you for your time, and I hope this has been of help.